Winters thought to himself, God, I can make it till Christmas. Just let me go home for Christmas. On July 1st, Winters received news of his promotion to captain. On July 10th, the company moved down to Utah Beach to prepare to embark for England. Seeing the beach for the first time, Winters recalled, with that armada of ships as far as the eye could see in every direction, and seeing the American flag on the beach, left me feeling weak in the knees for a few moments and brought tears to my eyes. Private Moore pulled one last raid on that vast supply dump. He broke into the main motor pool and stole a motorcycle complete with sidecar. He hid it behind a sand dune, then asked Captain Winters if he could put it on the LST and take it back to England. Up to you, Winters replied. The next day, as the company marched up the ramp of the gigantic LST, Moore moved the motorcycle up to the inland side of the forward dune. He had arranged with Malarkey for a hand signal when everyone was aboard and it was time to go. Malarkey tipped off the Navy personnel. At the proper moment, standing on the ramp, Malarkey gave the signal and Moore came roaring over the dune and up the ramp. On the LST, the skipper said to Welsh, Lieutenant, what would your men like to have? Chicken or steak? Ice cream? Eggs? Sailing in convoy, the LST got back to Southampton the night of July 12th. The next morning, a train took the men, except Moore and Malarkey, who rode their motorcycle, to Altbourne. It was wonderful to be back, Winters remembered. Everybody was glad to see us. It was just like home. Chapter 7 Healing Wounds and Scrubbed Missions. Altbourne, July 13th through September 16th, 1944. It's the only time I ever saw the Army do anything right, Gordon Carson said. They put us on those LSTs, brought us into Southampton, took us back to Altbourne, gave us two sets of complete all-new uniforms, all our back pay, $150 or more, and a 7-day pass. And by 7-8 in the morning, we're on our way to London. The men of Easy have little memory of that week in London. The American paratroopers were the first soldiers to return to England from Normandy. The papers had been full of their exploits. Everyone in town wanted to buy them a meal or a beer, for the first day or so. But the young heroes overdid it. They drank too much, they broke too many windows and chairs, they got into too many fights with non-paratroopers. It was one of the wildest weeks in London's history. One newspaper compared the damage done to the Blitz. A joke went around. The MPs in London were going to receive a presidential citation for duty above and beyond during the week the 101st was in town. Not everyone went to London. Harry Welsh traveled to Ireland to see relatives. Winters stayed in Altbourne to rest, reflect, and write letters to the parents of men killed or wounded. Gordon and Lipton, after recovery from their wounds, went to Scotland to see the sights. In the hospital, after his evacuation from Normandy, Gordon had been given skin grafts, then had his leg enclosed in a cast that ran from hip to toe. He was the only combat-wounded man in his ward. The others were ill or had been hurt in accidents in England. He was therefore an object of great respect. They were in awe of me. 3 times officers came in to pin a Purple Heart on his pillow. I would lower my eyes modestly and murmur thanks to the small group who had gathered to see the hero. Then he would hide the medal and wait for the next one. After 8 weeks in the hospital, he returned to E Company. It was airborne policy to return recovered men to their original company. In the infantry, when wounded became fit for duty, they went wherever they were needed. The former was, in the opinion of every paratrooper, one of the wisest things the airborne did. The latter policy was, in everyone's opinion, one of the dumbest things the Army did. Sergeant Talbert got back to Easy at the same time Gordon did. As his wound had been inflicted by Private Smith's bayonet rather than by a German, he was disqualified from receiving the Purple Heart. Gordon told him not to worry. He could fix him up with one of his extra ribbons. The third platoon got together and conducted an appropriate ceremony for Talbert. Gordon and Rogers had written a poem to immortalize Talbert, Smith, and the bayonet that came between them. The title was The Night of the Bayonet. Fortunately for posterity, the poem has not survived, or at least the authors refused to give it to me for this book. The indignant Talbert declared, "I could have shot the little bastard 6 times as he lunged toward me, but I didn't think we could spare a man at the time." Some of the wounded were worried about permanent disability. Malarkey found this out when he and Don Moon were sitting in the mess hall as Lipton passed by. "Hi, Crip," Malarkey called out. Lipton turned and grabbed the two men by their throats, lifted them from their chairs, and declared that he would take them on one at a time or together. They went pale and said they didn't mean anything by the crack. Later, Lipton returned, red-faced, and said he was sorry to lose his temper, but he feared that the wound to his hand had inflicted permanent damage that would prevent him from playing college football. Underlying the release of tension in London, or Gordon's feeble attempts at some humor, was the reality these men had faced and their apprehension about what they would be facing. Sergeant Martin looked around the 1st Platoon barracks the first night back from Normandy, and half the men who had been there from September 1943 to May 1944 were gone. He said to Guarnieri, "Jesus, Bill, here we've got a half a hut full of guys, and we aren't even started in the war yet. We don't have a Chinaman's chance of ever getting out of this thing." "If we lost half the barracks in one goddamn little maneuver in Normandy," Guarnieri replied, "forget it. We'll never get home." They took their leave in Scotland, where they got tattoos, figuring, what the hell? Losing that many men in one little deal like that, and the whole war ahead of us, why not? Private David Kenyon Webster had jumped with 2nd Battalion's HQ Company on D-Day, been wounded a few days later, evacuated to England, and returned to Altborn before the battalion returned. He hid in the shadows of the Red Cross hut as the thin, tired column of survivors marched into the area, hoping that no one would look him in the face and ask, "Where the hell were you, Webster, when the Krauts made the big counterattack on the other side of Carentin, and F Company gave ground and E Company's flank was exposed?" His embarrassment aside, Webster was overjoyed to see his friends return. "You know everybody in the battalion by sight," he wrote, "if not by name, "and you feel like part of a big family. You are closer to these men than you will ever be to any civilians." He applied for a transfer back to E Company, because with HQ Company, he had been an ammunition carrier most of the time, had fired his machine gun only once in Normandy, and I craved action. I wanted to get the war over with. I wanted to fight as a rifleman in a line company. He became a member of 1st Platoon. Webster's attitude was, as he wrote his parents, "I am living on borrowed time. I do not think I shall live through the next jump. If I don't come back, try not to take it too hard. I wish I could persuade you to regard death as casually as we do over here. In the heat of battle, you expect casualties. You expect somebody to be killed, and you are not surprised when a friend is machine-gunned in the face. You have to keep going. It's not like civilian life where sudden death is so unexpected." When his mother wrote to express her considerable alarm at this attitude, and her worries about his younger brother who had just joined the paratroopers, Webster was blunt in his reply. "Would you prefer for somebody else's son to die in the mud? You want us to win the war, but you apparently don't want to have your sons involved in the actual bloodshed. That's a strangely contradictory attitude. Somebody has to get in and kill the enemy. Somebody has to be in the infantry and the paratroops. If the country all had your attitude, nobody would fight. Everybody would be in the quartermaster. And what kind of a country would that be?" Lipton felt that when men are in combat, the inevitability of it takes over. They are there. There is nothing they can do to change that, so they accept it. They immediately become callous to the smell of death, the bodies, the destruction, the killing, the danger. Enemy bodies and wounded don't affect them. Their own wounded and the bodies of their dead friends make only a brief impression. And in that impression is a fleeting feeling of triumph or accomplishment that it was not them. Thank God it was him and not me is a common feeling to many combat soldiers when their comrades fall. Later, it can produce guilt feelings. There is still work to be done, a war to be won, and they think about that. Once out of the line, back in the rest camp, Lipton goes on, they begin to think. They remember how their friends were wounded or killed. They remember times when they were inches or seconds from their own death. Far from combat, death and destruction are no longer inevitable. The war might end. The missions might be canceled. With these thoughts, men become nervous about going back in. As soon as they are back in, however, those doubts and that nervousness are gone. The callousness, the cold-bloodedness, the calmness return. Once more, there's a job to be done. The old confidence comes back, the thrill of combat returns, and the drive to excel and win takes over again. If that sounds idealized, it can't be helped. That is the way Lipton and many others in EZ, and many others in the Airborne and throughout the American Army, and come to that, in the German and Red Armies too, fought the war. But by no means does Lipton's analysis apply to all soldiers. Millions of men fought in World War II. No one man can speak for all of them. Still, Lipton's insights into the emotional state of the combat soldier provide guidance into attempting to understand how men put up with combat. Coming out of Normandy, many of the men of EZ were fighting mad at the Germans and absolutely convinced the Allies would win the war. "I hope to go back soon," Webster told his parents, "for I owe the Germans several bullets and as many hand grenades as I can throw." The Germans had cut the throats of paratroops caught in their harnesses, bayoneted them, stripped them, shot them, wiped out an aid station. "Because of these atrocities, we do not intend to show them mercy." As to the outcome, after seeing that beachhead, a breathtaking panorama of military might, I know we cannot lose. As for the paratroopers, they are out for blood. I hope to be back in on the kill. Promotions were made. Welsh and Compton moved up from second to first lieutenant. Regiment needed new junior officers to replace casualties. Winters recommended Sergeant James Deal, who had acted as company first sergeant in Normandy, for a battlefield commission. Colonel Sink approved. So Deal became a second lieutenant and was assigned to another company in the 506th. Winters moved Lipton up to replace him as company first sergeant. Leo Boyle became staff sergeant at Company HQ. Bill Guarnieri became a staff sergeant. Don Malarkey, Warren Muck, Paul Rogers, and Mike Ranney jumped from private to sergeant. Ranney had been a sergeant but was busted to PFC during the Sobel Mutiny. Pat Christensen, Walter Gordon, John Plesha, and Levon Rees were promoted from private to corporal. Webster was an aspiring novelist, an avid reader of the best in English literature, a Harvard man, a combat veteran who praised and damned the army on the basis of personal observation and keen insight. His long letters home provide snapshots of some of the men of EZ Company, following its first combat experience. Private Roy Cobb, who had been hit on Harry Welsh's plane over Normandy and thus did not make the jump, was an old soldier with some 9 years to his credit. He managed to keep one long, easy jump ahead of the army. His varied and colorful wartime career had thus far included 1. An assault landing in Africa with the 1st Armored Division, 2. A siege of Yellow Jaundice and an evacuation to America on a destroyer after his troopship had been torpedoed, 3. Several months training at the parachute school, 4. A timely leg wound from flak over Normandy, tall, lean, thirsty, and invariably good-natured. The first squad of the first platoon was headed by little Johnny Martin, an excellent soldier, a premier gold brick, and a very fast thinker who could handle any combat or garrison problem that arose. Always had the equipment, the food, and the good living quarters. The second squad leader was Bull Randleman, who was constantly bitching but who could be very GI, as I once discovered when he turned me in to the first sergeant for laughing at him when he told me to take off my wool-knit hat in the mess hall. Bull was considered a very acceptable non-com by the officers who frowned on Sergeant Martin's flip attitude. Webster's squad leader was Sergeant Robert Rader. I don't think Rader ever gold-bricked in his life. He was the ideal garrison soldier, the type that knows all the commands for close-order drill and takes pride in a snappy manual of arms, that is impatient with men who ride the sick book and slip away from night problems. The assistant squad leaders, Corporals William Dukeman, Pat Christensen, and Don Hubler, generally let the buck sergeants do the work. Dukeman had a way of beating night problems and skipping off to London every weekend that was truly marvelous to behold. Christensen was Randleman's assistant, which Webster considered a snap job because Randleman, like Rader, was very conscientious. Christensen was of medium height and athletic build with curly golden hair. E Company's only glamour boy. Hubler was his opposite in every way. Hubler was the only person I met who actually enjoyed fighting. He got a kick out of war. A happy-go-lucky gold-tooth boy, he volunteered for all the patrols in combat and all the soft jobs in garrison. He was one of the best and most popular soldiers in the company. In Webster's opinion, and he had been around a lot as a member of HQ Company, the members of 1st Platoon E Company were younger, more intelligent than those in other companies. For the first time in the Army, and to his delight, he found men who talked about going to college after the war, including Corporal Dukeman and Sergeants Muck, Carson, and Malarkey. All these men were what Webster called new Army non-coms. Their average age was 21. They did not know the Articles of War backward and forward. They didn't care about the book that ruled the lives of so many regular Army men. They mingled with their men. They had not served in Panama or Hawaii or the Philippines. They were civilian soldiers. They were the ones who saved America. Webster was also impressed by some of the officers. He described Winters as a sizable, very athletic individual who believed in calisthenics in garrison and aggressiveness in combat. Welsh was now Winter's executive officer. Webster described him as small, dark, lazy, quick-thinking, the only officer in the 2nd Battalion who could give an interesting and informative current events lecture. He thought Lieutenant Compton, leader of the 2nd Platoon, a friendly and genial man who was everyone's favorite. He had convinced the college-bound group that UCLA was the only place to go for an education. 1st Platoon was led by Lieutenant Thomas Peacock, a replacement officer. Webster wrote that he always obeyed an order without question, argument, or thought. Webster felt that Peacock was highly esteemed by his superior officers and cordially disliked by his men. He was too GI. Once the platoon came back to Altborn from a 10-hour cross-country march. Peacock made the men play a baseball game because that was what was on the schedule. Peacock believed in the book. He was in his element in Normandy as battalion supply officer, but as a platoon leader, his men hated even to look at him. Peacock's assistant was Lieutenant Bob Brewer. Very young, a superb athlete, Webster described him as overgrown, boyish. In the summer of 1944, Easy Company had excellent billets. The officers were in a lovely brick house near the village green. In the back there were stables, which the men cleaned out and used. The stables consisted of a series of box stalls, in each of which four men lived in comfort and a dark, welcome privacy. There they could hide. So many did so when night training exercises resumed that Winters was forced to make a habit of checking the individual stalls to be certain no one was hiding behind the bunks or standing in the clothes hanging from the hooks. Beyond cover and concealment, each stall had a stove, a large, thick, soundproof door, and a high, airy ceiling. There was sufficient room to hang uniforms and barracks bags and still play poker or craps. For entertainment, the men listened to Armed Forces Network, AFN, radio. It was on from 0700 to 2300, with an occasional rebroadcast of a Bob Hope show, BBC News every hour, and swing music. The men much preferred it to BBC broadcasts, even though they had to endure SHAEF exhortations to keep clean, salute more often, or refrain from fighting. Remember, men, if you're looking for a fight, wait till you meet the Germans. When they didn't like the tune being played on AFN, they could turn to German radio and listen to Axis Sally and Lord Haw Haw. These propagandists played popular tunes, intermixed with messages that were so crudely done they always brought a laugh. In addition to the radio, there were movies twice a week, usually cowboy thrillers, seldom a recent release. Occasionally, a United Services Organization USO show came to the area, but generally the big stars stuck to London. Glenn Miller was an exception. For malarkey, the big thrill of the summer came on July 25th, when he was one of six men in the company to get a ticket to a concert given by Miller and his Army Air Force Band in Newbury. 47 years later, malarkey could remember the program. Miller started with Moonlight Serenade, the most thought-provoking theme song ever written, according to malarkey, followed by In the Mood. On weekends, when they were not in a marshalling area or on an alert, the men got passes. Malarkey and Moore would jump on their motorcycle and head for the South Coast, Brighton, Bournemouth, or Southampton, for swimming and sunbathing. Upon returning from one such excursion, they got a message from Captain Sobel. He wanted Malarkey and Moore to know that he knew they had the motorcycle and that it was stolen, but he was not going to do anything about it, except that he intended to confiscate it when the company next went into combat. Malarkey figured that Sobel's relatively reasonable attitude was a result of his unwillingness to confront Captain Winters. What was not so pleasant as the billets or the radio or the weekends was the training. "I got the impression we were being punished for going to Normandy," Webster wrote. "There was a dreary list of parades, inspections, field problems, night problems, and trips to the firing range." Winters had smuggled some live ammunition back to Altborn from Normandy. He used it to give the replacements the feel of advancing in an attack under covering fire. There was a risk involved, obviously to the men on maneuvers, but also to Winters himself, as it was unauthorized, and if anyone had been wounded, it would have been his fault. But he felt the risk was worthwhile, because he had learned on June 6th at Braycourt Manor that the key to a successful attack was to lay down a good, steady base of fire and then advance right under it. Done correctly, the job got accomplished with few casualties. The training exercises were necessary in order to give the replacements in the company — nearly half the company was made up of recruits by this time, just over from the States after completing jump school — the feel of live fire, and to integrate them into the company. But necessary or not, they were hated. Still, compared to the 1943 experience in Altborn, the summer of 1944 was a joy. Malarkey explained, "We are no longer subject to the discipline and vindictiveness of Herbert Sobel and Sergeant Evans." With Dick Winters, fairness and compassion replaced the unreasonableness of his predecessor. The esprit de corps in the company increased tremendously. It helped morale that, however rigorous the training program, Easy was spending the summer in Altborn rather than Normandy. "I thank God and General Eisenhower that we returned to England, Webster wrote his parents, "whenever I think of the Pacific boys, living in jungles and on barren coral reefs, and of the infantry in France, grinding forward without music or entertainment of any kind until they are killed or wounded." All the men in Altborn were keenly aware that the 4th Infantry Division, their partners on D-Day, were still on the line, taking casualties, sleeping in foxholes, eating K-rations, never bathing. Rumors were constant. On August 10th, Eisenhower himself inspected the division, which convinced everyone that the next combat jump was coming immediately, a conviction reinforced on August 12th when brand new equipment was handed around. Some were sure it was off for the South Pacific, others thought India, others Berlin. Those rumors were ridiculous, of course, but what fed them was the fact that the division made plans for 16 operations that summer, each one of which was canceled. The problem was that through to the end of July, the front line in Normandy was nearly static. Then Bradley's First Army broke out at Saint-Lô, Patton's Third Army went over to Normandy, and the American ground forces overran proposed drop zones before the paratroopers could complete their plans and make the jump. On August 17th, Easy was alerted and briefed for a drop near Chartres to set up roadblocks to cut off supplies and reinforcements for the Germans in Normandy and to block their escape route. The company, along with the rest of the battalion, took buses to the marshalling area at Membury Airdrome outside Altborn. They were fed steak and eggs, fried chicken, white bread, milk, ice cream. They checked their weapons and equipment, went over their briefing, discussed their objective. The recruits were excited, tense, eager, nervous. The veterans were worried. "I hate to think of going again," Webster wrote in his diary. What worried him most of all was the thought of being killed in his chute as he came down, swinging helplessly in the air, or getting caught in a tree or on a telephone pole, and being bayoneted or shot before he could free himself. He had acquired a .45 automatic pistol, but it was no match for a distant machine gun. He felt that if he could live through the jump, he could take the rest as it came. Talking to the subdued veterans around him at the airdrome, he noticed that the boys aren't as enthusiastic or anxious to get it over with as they were before Normandy. Nobody wants to fight anymore. Some hope was expressed that with Patton racing across France, the Allies on the offensive in Italy, the Red Army moving forward relentlessly on the Eastern Front, and the Wehrmacht high command in turmoil after the July 20th attempt on Hitler's life, Germany might collapse any day. Most of the men would have welcomed such a development, but not Webster, who wrote his parents, "I cannot understand why you hope for a quick end of the war. Unless we take the horror of battle to Germany itself, unless we fight in their villages, blowing up their houses, smashing open their wine cellars, killing some of their livestock for food, unless we litter their streets with horribly rotten German corpses, as was done in France, the Germans will prepare for war, unmindful of its horrors. Defeat must be brought into Germany itself, before this mess can come to a proper end. A quick victory now, a sudden collapse, will leave the countryside relatively intact, and the people thirsty for revenge. I want the war to end as quickly as anybody wishes, but I don't want the nucleus of another war left whole." August 19th was D-Day for Chartres. It was scheduled to be a daylight drop. All around Membury that morning, men were getting up at first light, after a more or less sleepless night spent mainly sweating on their cots, imagining all sorts of possibilities. They dressed silently. They were detached and gloomy. No one was cutting Mohawk haircuts. There were no shouts of, "Look out, Hitler, here we come." It was more a case of, "Mama, if you ever prayed for me, pray for me now." Joyous news over the radio. Patton's Third Army tanks had just taken the DZ at Chartres. The jump was canceled. The men shouted. They jumped up and down. They laughed. They blessed George Patton and his tankers. They cheered and danced. That afternoon, they returned to Aldbourne. On Sunday morning, August 28th, the 506th held a memorial service for the men killed in Normandy. When it was announced that the men would have to give up their Sunday morning, there was terrific moaning and groaning. As one trooper put it, he would honor the dead on Saturday morning or all day Monday, but he'd be damned if he'd honor the dead on his own time. But that was just talk, a soldier exercising his inalienable right to grouse. He put on his Class A uniform and went along with the rest. Easy Company was taken by buses to Regimental HQ on the estate of Lord Wills at Littlecote, outside Chilton Foliat, where it joined the other companies on a soft green field. A band played the Dead March in such a slow cadence that everyone got out of step. But once the regiment was in place, the 2,000 young American warriors spread like a solid brown carpet on the lawn, the grand castle before them. It made an inspiring sight. Chaplain McGee gave a talk, saying the dead really were heroic. America really was worth dying for. Those who died did not die in vain, and so on. The men were more impressed by the regimental prayer written by Lieutenant James Morton and read by the chaplain. Almighty God, we kneel to thee and ask to be the instrument of thy fury in smiting the evil forces that have visited death, misery, and debasement on the people of the earth. Be with us, God, when we leap from our planes into the dark abyss and descend in parachutes into the midst of enemy fire. Give us iron will and stark courage as we spring from the harnesses of our parachutes to seize arms for battle. The legions of evil are many, Father. Grace our arms to meet and defeat them in thy name and in the name of the freedom and dignity of man. Let our enemies who have lived by the sword turn from their violence, lest they perish by the sword. Help us to serve thee gallantly and to be humble in victory. General Taylor came next, but his speech was drowned out by a formation of C-47s passing overhead. Then the roster of the dead and missing was read out. It seemed to drone on endlessly. There were 414, and each name brought a sharp intake of breath from the surviving members of the soldier's squad, platoon, company. Each time he heard the name of a man he knew, Webster thought of his family sitting quietly in a home that will never be full again. The readings ceased abruptly with a private whose name began with Z. The regiment marched off the field to the tune of Onward, Christian Soldiers. The 101st Airborne Division was now a part of the 1st Allied Airborne Army, which included the U.S. 17th, 82nd, and 101st Airborne. Together, the U.S. units constituted the 18th Airborne Corps. The Polish 1st Parachute Brigade and the British 1st and 6th Airborne Divisions, plus the 52nd Lowlanders, air transported. General Matthew Ridgway commanded the 18th Corps. General Lewis Brereton commanded the Airborne Army. General Taylor remained in command of the 101st. General James Gavin commanded the 82nd. All these generals and their senior subordinates were itching to get the Airborne Army into action. But every time they made a plan, briefed the men, transported them to the marshaling areas, and prepared to load up, the ground troops overran the DZ and the mission was canceled. It happened again at the end of August. On the 30th, at midnight, Taylor ordered company formations. The men were told to pack their bags for an 0800 departure for Membury. At the airdrome, along with all the other activity, a money exchange took place. English pounds for Belgian francs. Thus, the men knew the objective even before the briefing. Finance officers told those who did not have a pound note, tough. The DZ was to be near Tournai, Belgium, just across the border from the French city of Lille. The aim was to open a path for the British Second Army in its drive across the Escaut Canal and into Belgium. 2 days of intense briefings, hectic preparations, and marvelous food followed. But on September 2nd, the Guards Armored Division of the British Second Army captured Tournai, and the operation was cancelled. There was the same relief as when the Chartres drop was cancelled, but the determination of the High Command to get the paratroopers into the action was so obvious to the men that even as they rode the bus back to Altborne, they acknowledged to each other that one of these times they would not be coming back from the airport. The Allied armies continued to roll through France and Belgium. The Airborne Army's High Command grew ever more desperate to get into the battle. It had the best troops in ETO, the best commanders, the highest morale, unmatched mobility, outstanding equipment. Officers and men were proved veterans who wanted another chance to show what paratroopers could do in modern war. The Airborne Army was by far Eisenhower's greatest unused asset. He wanted to keep the momentum of the advance going. He wanted to seize the moment to deliver a decisive blow before the Germans could recover from their six-week-long retreat through France. When Montgomery proposed to utilize the Airborne Army in a complex, daring, and dangerous but potentially decisive operation to get across the lower Rhine River, Eisenhower quickly agreed, to the immense delight of the Airborne Army Command. Code name was Market Garden. The objective was to get British Second Army, with the Guards Armored Division in the van, through Holland and across the Rhine on a line Eindhoven, Zonne, Wagel, Grave, Nijmegen, Arnhem. The British tanks would move north along a single road, following a carpet laid down by the American and British paratroopers, who would seize and hold the many bridges between the start line and Arnhem. The British 1st Airborne Division, reinforced by the Poles, would be at the far end of the proposed line of advance, at Arnhem. The 82nd Airborne would take and hold Nijmegen. The 101st's task was to land north of Eindhoven with the objective of capturing that town while simultaneously moving through Zonne toward Wagel and Grave, to open the southern end of the line of advance. The task of the 2nd Battalion of the 506th PIR was to take the bridge over the Wilhelmina Canal at Zonne intact, then join the 3rd Battalion in attacking Eindhoven, where it would hold the city and its bridges until the Guards Armored Division passed through. It was a complicated but brilliant plan. Success would depend on execution of almost split-second timing, achieving surprise, hard fighting, and luck. If everything worked, the payoff would be British armored forces on the North German plain, on the far side of the Rhine, with an open road to Berlin. If the operation failed, the cost would be the squandering of the asset of the Airborne Army, failure to open the port of Antwerp. Eisenhower had to agree to put off the commitment of troops needed to open that port in order to mount Market Garden. A consequent supply crisis throughout ETO, and a dragging out of the war through the winter of 1944 through 45. In addition to putting off the opening of Antwerp, Eisenhower had to stop Patton east of Paris to get sufficient fuel for the British Second Army to mount Market Garden. In short, the operation was a roll of the dice, with the Allies putting all their chips into the bet. On September 14th, Easy took the buses back to the Membury marshalling area. On the 15th, the company got its briefing. It was reassuring. The men were told this was to be the largest airborne landing in history, 3 divisions strong. It would be a daylight landing. Unlike Normandy, it would come as a surprise to the Germans. Flak would be light, the initial ground opposition almost non-existent. In the marshalling area, waiting to go, there was a great deal of gambling. One of the recruits, Private Cecil Pace, was a fanatic gambler. To the chagrin of the veterans, he won $1,000 at craps. Colonel Sink gave the regiment a pep talk. "You'll see the British tanks," he said, "some of them Sherman's and the others Cromwell's. Don't mistake the Cromwell's for German tanks. And those guards' divisions, they're good outfits. Best in the British Army. You can't get in them unless you've got a sir in front of your name and a pedigree a yard long. But don't laugh at them. They're good fighters. Another thing, he went on, rubbing his face, I didn't want to see any of you running around in Holland in wool-knit caps. General Taylor caught a 506th man wearing one of those caps in Normandy and gave me hell for it. Now I don't want to catch hell, see, and I know you don't, so if you've got to wear a wool-knit cap, keep it under your helmet. And don't let General Taylor catch you with that helmet off. I know you men can do all right, so I don't have to talk about fighting. This is a good enough outfit to win a presidential citation in Normandy. Now you old men, look after the replacements, and we'll all get along fine. Webster recorded that it was always a pleasure to listen to Sink, because he had a sensible, realistic, humorous approach to combat. General Taylor was his opposite. In Webster's opinion, Taylor had a repellently optimistic, cheerleading attitude. Colonel Sink knew the men hated to fight. Up to the end of the war, General Taylor persisted in thinking that his boys were anxious to kill Germans. We preferred Colonel Sink. On September 16th, Private Stroll, who had been in the hospital since June 13th, got a one-day pass from the doctors. He hitched a ride to Altborn, where he ran into Captain Sobel, who was ferrying baggage back to Membury. Sobel told Stroll that the company was about to go into action. Stroll said he wanted to join up and asked for a ride to the airdrome. Sobel warned him, "You're going to be AWOL." Stroll responded that he did not think he would get into big trouble by choosing to go into combat with his company, so Sobel told him to hop in. "It was a stupid thing to do," Stroll said 4 decades later. "I was as weak as a pussycat." But he wasn't going to let his buddies go into action without him. He got himself equipped and climbed into a C-47. Popeye Wynn, who had been shot in the butt helping to destroy the battery at Braecourt Manor on June 6th, had been operated on and was recuperating in a hospital in Wales when he was told that if he was absent from his company for more than 90 days, when he was listed fit for combat, he would be assigned to a different outfit. Wynn wanted none of that. He persuaded a sergeant, who was in charge of releasing the patients, to send him back to Altborn with light-duty papers. He arrived on September 1st, threw away the papers, and rejoined the 3rd Platoon. He was not fully recovered. During the flight to Holland, he stood up in the back of the stick, as he was too sore to sit. But he was there, where he wanted to be, going into combat with his buddies in easy company. Chapter 8. Hell's Highway. Holland, September 17th through October 1st, 1944. It was a beautiful end-of-summer day in northwest Europe, with a bright blue sky and no wind. The Allied airborne attack came as a surprise to the Germans. There were no Luftwaffe planes to contest the air armada. Once over Holland, there was some anti-aircraft fire, which intensified 5 minutes from the DZ. But there was no breaking of formation or evasive action by the pilots, as there had been over Normandy. Easy came down exactly where it was supposed to be. So did virtually all the companies in the division. The landing was soft, on freshly plowed fields, in the memory of the men of Easy, the softest they ever experienced. Webster wrote his parents, "It was the most perfectly flat jump field I've ever seen." Basically, Holland is just a big, glorified jump field. The official history of the 101st declared that this was the most successful landing that the division had ever had, in either training or combat. The only problem Winters could recall was the need to get off the DZ as soon as possible to avoid getting hit by falling equipment and landing gliders. It was just raining equipment, he said. Helmets, guns, bundles. Malarkey remembered running off the field to the assembly area, marked by smoke grenades. He heard a crash overhead. 2 gliders had collided and came plummeting to earth. There was no German opposition on the ground. The company assembled quickly and set off toward its objective. The objective was a bridge over the Wilhelmina Canal at Zonn. The route was over a north-south road that ran from Eindhoven to Wegel to Nijmegen to Arnhem. The road was part asphalt, part brick, wide enough for two automobiles to pass each other, but a tight squeeze for two trucks. Like most roads in Holland, it was a meter or so above the surrounding fields, meaning that anything moving on it stood out against the horizon. The road was the key to Operation Market Garden. The task for the American airborne troops was to take control of the road and its many bridges to open a path for the British 30th Corps, with the Guards Armored Division in the van, to drive through to Arnhem and thus over the lower Rhine River. Easy landed about 30 kilometers behind the front line, some 15 kilometers north of Eindhoven. The 506th initial objective was Zonn, then Eindhoven, which meant the initial march was south. The regiment moved out with 1st Battalion going through the field to the west of the road, 2nd Battalion down the road, 3rd Battalion in reserve. 2nd Battalion order of march was D Company leading, then E Company, Battalion HQ, and F Company following. The column entered Zonn. The residents were drawn up on each side of the road as for a parade. Unlike Normandy, where the French villagers mainly stayed out of sight, the Dutch were ecstatic to be liberated. The parish priest, Hussen of Zonn, handed out cigars. Orange flags, forbidden by the German occupiers, flew from the windows. People gave the passing paratroopers apples and other fruit. Bartenders opened their taps and handed out glasses of beer. Officers had a hard time keeping the men moving. Emerging from Zonn, less than a kilometer from the bridge, the column was fired on by a German 88 and by a machine gun, both shooting straight down the road. There were no casualties. D Company covered the right side of the road, E Company the left. They pushed forward, firing rifles and lobbing mortar shells, which silenced the opposition. But the Germans had done their job, delaying the advance long enough to complete their preparations for blowing the bridge. When the lead American elements were 25 meters or less from the bridge, it blew in their faces. There was a hail of debris of wood and stone. Winters, with Nixon beside him, hit the ground. Big pieces of timber and large rocks rained down around him. Winters thought to himself, what a hell of a way to die in combat. Colonel Sink ordered 2nd Battalion to lay down a covering fire while 1st Battalion looked for a way to get over the canal. Corporal Gordon Carson of Easy spotted a couple of waterlogged rowboats on the far side and decided an immediate action. He stripped stark naked, made a perfect racing dive into the water, swam across, and fetched a boat that carried some men from the 1st Squad about halfway over the canal before it sank. Other men from 1st Battalion, more practical, took the doors off a nearby barn and, with the help of Sergeant Lipton and several E Company men, laid them across the bridge pilings. The German rear guard, its mission accomplished, withdrew. Engineers attached to the regiment improved the footbridge over the canal, but it was so weak that it could bear only a few men at a time. It took the battalion hours to get across. It was getting dark. Sink got word that the Guards Armored Division had been held up by 88s a few kilometers south of Eindhoven, and he did not know the state of German defenses in the city. He ordered a halt for the night. The platoon leaders posted outposts. Those not on duty slept in haystacks, woodsheds, whatever they could find. Privates Hubler and Webster of Sergeant Rader's 2nd Squad 1st Platoon found a farmhouse. The Dutch farmer welcomed them. He led them through the barn, already occupied with Regimental Headquarters Company. You shoot 'em, we loot 'em was its motto, who resented their presence. On to the kitchen, where the Dutchman gave them half a dozen mason jars filled with preserved meat, peaches, and cherries. Hubler gave him some cigarettes, and Webster handed him a D-ration chocolate bar. He sucked in the smoke greedily, the first decent cigarette he had enjoyed in 5 years, but saved the candy for his little boy, who had never tasted chocolate. Webster decided on the spot that he liked the Dutch much better than the British or French. In the morning, the march resumed, with 2nd Battalion following 1st Battalion on the road south. On the edge of Eindhoven, a city of 100,000 that rose abruptly from the rich black soil, Colonel Sink spread his regiment, sending 2nd Battalion out to the left, with Easy on the far left flank. Winters gave the order over his radio. Lieutenant Brewer, put your scouts out and take off. Brewer spread 1st Platoon out in textbook formation, scouts to the front, no bunching up, moving fast. The platoon advanced through truck gardens and freshly plowed fields toward the houses on the edge of the city. There was only one thing wrong. Brewer was in front, with his map case at his side, his binoculars hanging around his neck. Obviously an officer. Worse, he was well over 6 feet tall. Gordon thought he looked like a field marshal on parade. He was a perfect target. Winters shouted over his radio, "Get back! Drop back! Drop back!" But Brewer could not hear him. He kept moving ahead. Every man in the company, every man in battalion, could see what was sure to happen. A shot rang out. A sniper had fired from one of the houses. Brewer went down like a tree felled by an expert lumberman. He had been shot in the throat, just below the jawline. Gordon and a couple of other enlisted men ran over to him, even though their orders were to keep moving and leave any wounded for the medics. They looked down at Brewer, bleeding profusely from his wound. "Ah, hell, forget him," someone said. "He's gone. He's going to die." They moved on, leaving Brewer lying there. He heard it all and never forgot it, and never let the men forget it when he recovered and rejoined the company. After that, there was only light scattered resistance, mainly from snipers. The 506th got into Eindhoven without further difficulty. The Dutch were out to welcome them. Many spoke English. "So nice to see you," they called out. "Glad you have come. We have waited so long." They brought out chairs, hot tea, fresh milk, apples, pears, peaches, orange flags and orange armbands, hidden for years, blossomed on all the houses and shirt sleeves. The applause was nearly deafening. The men had to shout to each other to be heard. "It was the most sincere Thanksgiving demonstration any of us were to see," Webster wrote, "and it pleased us very much." It took most of the rest of the day to push through the crowds to secure the bridges over the Dommel River. It did not matter. The British tankers did not show up until late that afternoon. They promptly stopped, set up housekeeping, and proceeded to make tea. Winters set up outposts. Those not on duty joined the celebration. They posed for pictures, signed autographs, some signing Monty, others Eisenhower, drank a shot or two of cognac, ate marvelous meals of fresh vegetables, roast veal, applesauce, and milk. The civilians continued to mob them as if they were movie stars. Winters still shakes his head at the memory. It was just unbelievable. The company spent the night in hastily dug foxholes in Tonchelre, a suburb on the east side of Eindhoven. On the morning of September 19th, Winters got orders to march east to Helmond, in order to broaden the Eindhoven section of the corridor and to make contact with the enemy. A squadron of Cromwell tanks from the Hussars accompanied Easy. Some of the men rode on the backs of the Cromwells. The tanks, Webster wrote, barked, sputtered, clanked, and squeaked in their accustomed manner as we set out. Winters led a forced march to Nunen, about 5 kilometers, encountering no opposition, but once again cheering Dutch, offering food and drink. Webster remarked that this was the village in which Vincent van Gogh had been born. "Who the hell's that?" Raeder asked. Beyond Nunen, the picnic ended. The Germans had recovered from their surprise and were beginning to mount counterattacks. "Kraut tanks! Kraut tanks!" Webster heard Private Jack Matthews call out. Oh, Jesus Christ, Webster thought to himself as he and the others jumped off the Cromwells to dive into a ditch. Less than 400 meters away, the first in a column of German tanks slithered through the bushes like an evil beast. The 107th Panzer Brigade, stationed in Helmand, was attacking west toward Nuenen with some 50 tanks, more than we had ever seen at one time, Winters recalled. Sergeant Martin saw a German tank almost hidden in a fence row about 100 meters away. A British tank was coming up. Martin ran back to it, climbed aboard, and told the commander there was an enemy tank just below and to the right. The tank continued to move forward. Martin cautioned the commander that if he continued his forward movement, the German tank would soon see him. "I can't see him, old boy," the commander replied, "and if I can't see him, I can't very well shoot at him." "You'll see him damn soon," Martin shouted as he jumped down and moved away. The German tank fired. The shell penetrated the British tank's armor. Flame erupted. The crew came flying out of the hatch. The gunner pulled himself out last. He had lost his legs. The tank, now a flaming inferno, continued to move forward on its own, forcing Bull Randleman to move in the direction of the enemy to avoid it. A second British tank came forward. It, too, got blasted. Altogether, four of the British tanks were knocked out by the German 88s. The two remaining tanks turned around and began to move back into Nuenen. Easy Company fell back with them. Sergeant Rogers had been hit. He was bleeding badly. "They kind of pinked you a little, didn't they, Paul?" Lipton said. Rogers let out a string of profanity that lasted a full minute. Lipton remembered, most unusual for him. Lieutenant Buck Compton got hit in the buttocks. Medic Eugene Rowe went to Compton's aid. Malarkey, Private Ed Heffron, and a couple of others came forward to help. As Heffron reached to help, Compton looked up and moaned, "She always said my big ass would get in the way." He looked at the five men gathered around him. "Take off," Compton ordered. "Let the Germans take care of me." He was such a big man, and the fire was so intense that the troopers were tempted to do just that. But Malarkey, Guarnieri, and Joe Toya pulled a door off a farm outbuilding and laid Compton face down on it. Then they skidded him up the roadside ditch to one of the retreating British tanks and loaded him face down onto the back end. The bullet that hit Compton had gone into the right cheek of his buttocks, out, into the left cheek, and out. Lipton looked at him and couldn't help laughing. "You're the only guy I ever saw in my life that got hit with one bullet and got four holes," he told Compton. Compton growled, "If I could get off this tank, I'd kill you." Other men joined Compton on the backs of the withdrawing tanks. Stroll and Gordon, who had been out on the flank, Stroll with a mortar and Gordon with his machine gun, had to run across an open field to rejoin the outfit. The weight of their weapons slowed them down. Bullets were kicking up the dirt at their feet. There was a 3-foot-high wooden fence between them and the road. "We hurdled it like two horses," Stroll said. Safely on the other side, they paused to catch their breath. "That's one thing you and I will never do again," Stroll said. "I don't think we did it the first time," Gordon replied. They took off again for the tanks, caught up, and Gordon pulled himself onto the back of one, but Stroll was dead beat. He put his hand up. Gordon grabbed it as Stroll passed out. Gordon hauled him aboard and got him secured. Randleman, who had been in the van, got hit in the shoulder and cut off from his squad. He ducked into a barn. A German soldier came running in behind him. Randleman bayoneted the man, killed him, and covered his body with hay. Then he covered himself up with hay and hid out. Once in town, men found shelter in buildings that they used as cover to move around and set up some semblance of a return fire. Easy managed to hold up the Germans, but was unable to force them back. Sergeant Chuck Grant got hit, among many others. Private Robert Van Klinken was killed by a machine gun burst when he tried to run forward with a bazooka. Private James Miller, a 19-year-old replacement, was killed when a hand grenade went off on his kidneys. Private Ray Cobb had the shakes. Webster heard Sergeant Martin comforting him, the way a mother talks to a dream-frightened child. "That's all right, Cobb, don't worry. We're not going back out there. Just relax, Cobb. Take it easy." Martin went over to a Cromwell, hiding behind a building. He pointed out the church steeple and asked the commander to take it out, as the Germans were using it as an observation post. "So sorry, old man, we can't do it," the commander replied. "We have orders not to destroy too much property. Friendly country, you know." The Germans kept pressing. Their aim was to get through to the highway leading from Eindhoven to